this is Richard Swanson, and it is the 13th of June, 2008, and we are working with origin stories today. Let's start with something that is, if possible, even more confusing than the translation that I handed you last time. We will definitely get to the translation.
Hello.
But I want to start with just a small portion of the beginning of the Kumulipo in Hawaiian. Now, I read almost no Hawaiian, not enough to even call it reading. I know 9 or 12 words, three of which are in this, which is really cool. But I want you to see it, and I want you to hear it and feel it, just so we have a place to start. Let's pass it this way.
Should we pull it on the circle, or?
Yeah, can we, I wonder how. If we pull all the way in, perhaps.
To pull in and spread out?
Yeah.
Spread out a little bit.
And if I could ask you, I started late, I should have said it before I passed it, but we're starting to catch up with the copy. When you get the copy in your hand, would you please introduce yourself again to all of us? And would you please tell us what it is that allows you to create? Okay? What it is that allows you to create? Okay, so for that, I am Richard Swanson, and what in the world allows me to create? Three things: fear, fascination, and love.
I'm Gundula, and
my name is Larry Huff. I need space.
My name is Carolyn Albert, and I was also going to say space, but space and breath.
I'm Liz, and I would say that dreaming allows me to create.
The task is to say your name and tell us what it is that allows you to create. He doesn't even get to hardly settle in before he has to answer that one.
Jack, sleep.
Yes.
Yes.
What did you say?
Rest.
Oh, rest.
Sabbath.
Yes.
Oh.
I have three words there, so I'll mix them up.
I'm Patty. I think some of the best poetry I've ever written was when I had a broken heart.
Judy, probably time to.
My name is Roy Satry, and I need time and freedom to create.
My name is Dean Zweck, and I need Zweck, which is German for purpose. I have to have a purpose, otherwise I can't create.
Question is, what we need to create.
What it is that allows you to create.
I'm Eric Holland.
I did three.
You did three. Oh, okay. I'm going to say a number of words. I'm tempted to say I need space, freedom, openness. But honestly, another reality is that I need a deadline. purpose. This is required of me. And somehow there's a freedom that emerges, or something that can emerge in that demand as well.
It's the dance of freedom and constraint.
Yeah. Bart, I think, once wrote about freedom and limitation.
Yeah.
That idea.
I'm Iola Erickson, and I don't know. I have to have a reason, and I have to have the initiative.
I need to be void of silly little pressures around the house and family, but I really need my imagination to be let loose, and I need the freedom to try things differently, to do things differently.
My name is Nick Martin, and in order to create, I need a wild and dynamic imagination that continues to flow due to my neuroticism.
Yes, and all those parts are essential to the task.
My name is Justin. I've had all this time to think a million things have gone through my head. For me, when I create a lot within many different mediums, and when I do, I'm not sure I need something, because it's almost like giving birth. You just have to let it happen. It's gonna happen, and there's nothing you can do about that. So really just to allow myself to be there in that creative space.
What it is that allows you to create?
My name is Julia, and
it was easy.
I can't remember the rest.
Okay, what I've handed you is the very first few lines of the Kumalipo in Hawaiian. As I said, I do not speak Hawaiian. I have no 5 or 9 words. But I wanted you to look at this first. Just as an artifact, look at lines 1 through 11. Hawaiian, of course, was not a written language until missionaries and other Europeans and Americans encountered the islands and stabilized it in Latin Western form, but it was not a written language. Hawaiian is a fascinating language to look at because the syllables are very short. Every vowel is a syllable. Every vowel is a syllable. And if there is a consonant, the consonant goes on the beginning of each syllable. So every syllable, if it begins, every syllable ends in a vowel. And if it begins with a consonant, it begins with a consonant, but otherwise not. So it's a language that ends up with, in fact, short syllables, but very, very long words. If you've driven in Hawaii, I find it maddening to drive in Hawaii because the street signs are that long and they have syllables that look very much the same, and it takes practice to find where the relevant meaning carriers are. But just looking at the first 11 lines, the Kumalipo has 2,000 and some hundred lines altogether. We're going to look at 11 to start with, not ever all 2,000. But what do you notice, just as an artifact?
Oh.
Lots of oh
Except for the fourth line.
Mm-hmm. Except for the fourth line and the 11th.
And
lots
the
of
I.
O.
Yeah. The I.
And the I by itself.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. The E sound.
P, or maybe that's not the vowel sound.
The sounds in Hawaiian are, it. The woman who taught me German said, as near as she could tell, she thought that Hawaiian had been phoneticized by someone who spoke German. So that if you make the sounds roughly like you would in German, you come out more or less right. The first line is O ke au I kahuli wela ka honua. The E sound, the letter E is pronounced A. The letter I is always pronounced E. They are not really diphthongs. It's actually au, but if you listen to people speak, they say it so quickly that my ear can't tell the difference between au and au as separate sounds. What else do you see?
Seems to be very rhythmic.
Yes.
Like the way the lines are shaped and the repetition, it's almost like the water imagery in the
yes.
first part of this is kind of echoed in the sound of the language.
Yes. How do you hear that? Or see it, or the water imagery fascinates me.
Well, the first set of animals that are created are all out of like fish in the sea, or
yes,
and the intrinsic nature or the connectedness of the people with the water is something I think needs to be taken into account.
Yeah. So that when you have the meanings, it's very clear that this is a very wet world being created. But just for now, just the patterns on the page and the language that none of us understands, very rhythmic.
Having listened to it some, I'm sort of looking at it, it's a very liquid language.
Yes, yes. With interesting glottal stops in the middle of the liquidity. Anytime there is a parenthesis, anytime there is an apostrophe, it's a glottal stop. So you, if the parenthesis would be, you know what I'm trying to say, it's just not coming out of my mouth. If the apostrophe would be between an E sound and an A sound, it would be E-A. So that you stop it in the middle, very liquid, with bumps. With marvelous little vacuums in the middle of the liquid. Bubbles, perhaps, as it were. What else? What else can you notice?
It's usually repetitive, isn't it?
Very much so. Some of that is every syllable has a vowel, and there are not that many vowel sounds that are needed. So you will have syllables that rhyme very easily because there are just a small handful of vowels. Very repetitive, and repetitive not just in the fact that you're going to have ka sounds over and over again, because that's a great pairing. Hawaiian uses ka, the K sound, a great deal. Hawaiian uses K sounds and T sounds and tends to interchange those two with other Polynesian languages. And po is there a lot. And we were actually playing an illegitimate teacher game, which was guess my brain. And that you just did. You were noticing things that we needed to notice, but I was waiting for someone to see po.
And that twice it's capitalized.
Yes.
And once not in the translation. It looks like it's the word for night.
It is. The word po means a number of things. It means dark. It means darkness. It means night. It means uncertainty. It means contingency. It means an impinging something that you don't know what it is. All of that is po. One of the things that you'll learn about Hawaiian, a little bit that I do know, is that it is, I've said many times here and elsewhere, Hebrew is an amazingly metaphorical language. Hawaiian is more metaphorical than Hebrew, which is strange. I never had imagined I would say that. It is a characteristic of languages with a small wortschatz, with a small treasury of words that they use, that they become powerfully and deeply metaphorical. Hawaiian has a small set of words that mean five things at once when it's a puny little word. When it's a strong word like po, it means more than you can trace. One of the things I learned listening to people explain Hawaiian to me was that not everyone tells you as much as anyone else tells you. So that you might, if you're explaining po to me, give me five words that it means. Gundala might give me 13. The variable appears to be what secrets you wanted to keep, or how much you trusted me to listen to the language and make sense of it, or how much you wanted to confuse me with the language that in fact expands into infinity. Po is darkness. Po is potential. Po is uncertainty. Po is night.
So you used five, six words to describe po. Would a Hawaiian have the capacity to use five words to define one word?
Yes, but what you find, what I find, again, I know a thimbleful and a half, two thimblefuls about some of this. When a Hawaiian speaks in English to explain a word, you can get 5, 9, 35 words in English that will explain to you how this word in this context would point that way and that context would point another. So yes, all of those were in fact words handed me by a Hawaiian to explain what po was. But when it's used in the language itself, from what I've been told, the word just sits there and expects you to know that the word fans out this way. And you need to know that it fans out this way because it means all of those things at once. Hawaiian is not a language that picks a fork and goes just down that road. At least in its poetry, in its chants, in its sacred stories, every word means many layers of things. That's going to matter in a very, very short while. Next word, do you see lipo?
That looks like darkness.
Lipo is darkness.
And then lipo, I see. It's like the intense darkness, deep darkness.
In Hawaiian? But lipo is an intensifier of po. Po itself is darkness, but lipo is darker than that. And in Hawaiian, when you want to intensify anything, you repeat it.
Coming this way.
So lipo is darker than that. Now, the chant is called not a creation chant. There's in fact nothing in this that says creation chant. The chant is called kumu lipo. Kumu is a word that means source. It means uterus. Kumo is a word that means teacher. Kumo is a word that means that out of which anything comes. And so kumo can be a mouth. Kumo can be all of that. Why would you call your origin chant kumu lipo? Since we have utter freedom, I don't know that anyone here is of Hawaiian descent. Make up a reason.
It is dark in the womb.
It is dark in the womb, yes? And so this is a womb of darkness. Kumu lipo. That works?
Maybe because kumu means that it's a source, if it's the source of darkness, or to translate it that way, and you take the uncertainty, impendency, or potential aspect of the word po, then it imagines a universe of potential and of uncertainty.
Yes.
And that is coming to be other things than what it is even now.
Yes, that means, that works, that tracks. What else shall we make up? Kumo lipo. one thing that matters, especially in the multi-layeredness of Hawaiian language, you may have noticed in the English version of the Kumulipo, all things come into being through birth. One of the things that shocked Christian missionaries, shocked them, was that the Hawaiian language and culture is so powerfully and gladly sexual. So the womb of darkness is both the source of light and the locus of pleasure, and both are meant with all their might. The first missionaries that arrived with their hundreds of buttoned dresses with full skirts and heavy woolen clothing and houses with small windows, and the Hawaiians looked at them and decided that they were obviously insane, they should be good to them. But the missionaries were just simply shocked at the glad sexuality of Hawaiian society. One of the things you find is that one of the layers of meaning on every word that I know is at some point carefully and happily sexual. Whether it is because of the notion of generativity being found everywhere, or whether it's because the notion is that anything that feels so good must be terrific, and so everything is terrific. Kumulipo. And behold, it was
very good.
That's not accidental to Hawaiian origin story. What else would you make up?
I like what you said about the teacher as well,
yes,
as all those things. It's sort of like something that's teaching the darkness into something else, or teaching it how to be,
yes,
a world. Or
yeah. So that somehow or other there's something that is giving birth to the world, but it is giving birth to teaching at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And teaching is a labor-intensive act. Yuck, yuck, yuck. It is an activity of bringing forth, and what is brought forth is lipo, or lipo is the means of bringing forth, teaching by night, teaching by darkness, teaching by ambiguity, teaching by uncertainty, teaching by potential, or teaching which embodies potential. All of it, you can reverse, and you have to reverse all of those terms to catch the nuances that are dancing in just this little bit.
Good teaching is passion.
Yes. Yes.
Mm.
What if the teaching, though, is you start at darkness, you move towards something else, so darkness is only the beginning. And like you also said, it could mean source. So from the darkness, there is a product.
Yes.
And so it's what's coming out of the darkness that maybe that's what's important or what's implied. And so instead of source of darkness, source from darkness.
And darkness is the instigator that allows things to be brought forth, is that?
Yeah.
Yes, and absolutely. That, in fact, that reversal of the terms is essential to Hawaiian understandings. Did you notice in the larger text that the last line in every Roman numeral piece was, still it was night, until the last line?
Well, in the act of teaching itself, you know, the idea is bringing light to darkness, or, you know, allowing
us,
well, according to us, but
yeah.
It's interesting because I see out of this, you know, what you were talking about, bringing out of all of this, you know, darkness, out of uncertainty, that which we cannot see, and then pulling something out of that, and then making it certain, bringing light to the situation. I mean, I think about, you know, if someone were to enter a situation where, you know, it's almost like a buffet of different life aspects, and you don't know where to turn, and then you have that teacher who grabs something for you and presents it to you, and then you have certainty presented in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I got from this.
Yeah. Something that the still it is night made me question was, it seemed to me, and I think it was partly my bias, but I was reading through the stanzas, I kind of felt like light was there, like I could see something that was happening. And so when at the end of the stanza I came to still, it was night, I was like, oh really, it's still night, isn't that day yet? But then I actually looked for it then in the text, and there's a line within the first Roman numeral section that says darkness slips into light.
Yes.
And it's still night at the end. And so the relationship between darkness and light, and the fact that maybe there can be light even though it's night, that Poe is maybe that nuanced of a word. That, I don't know, I think the language wants to be really ambiguous and wants night to continue to be throughout, I don't know.
Yes, yes. And night, in fact, of course, does have light in it. With a full moon, one sees remarkably well. Lipo is darkness of all darkness. Lipo is plenty dark, but Po itself is a broad range. If we're just talking average night, we're going to have a slightly better than half moon tonight. And that means we'll see slightly better than half well, even after all the lights are gone. A full moon in Hawaii is a really remarkable thing. So, have you been to Hawaii? Mm-hmm. What do you know about darkness in Hawaii? Any? Did you notice anything about darkness in Hawaii?
No.
I go there with a class about every few years. A colleague in history and I teach a course in Hawaii about, it's called Missionaries, Migrants, and Money. And we look at the impact of outsiders on Native Hawaiian culture. It's not bad to teach a course in Hawaii in January. We have a lot of people who are there intending to study the beach intensely. And I have them read post-colonial theory. And they do. But the thing that is astonishing to me is that the days are 83 degrees. The most boring job in the world must be weatherman in Hawaii on average. Because every night they stand up and say, and the temperature tonight will be 78, and the temperature tomorrow will be 83. It'll rain in Hilo, and it won't in Kailua Kona. I swear, they recorded all of that 25 years ago, and the guy's long dead. And just run it every night, the same thing. But when it's 83 degrees in the day, where I come from, the sun is up until 10 o'clock at night. And it comes up again at about 4, 4:30. In Hawaii, the sun goes down at 6 and comes up at 6. In the summer, the days are much longer. The sun goes down at 6:08 and comes up at 5:52. It's closer to the equator than I've ever lived. And so the days are remarkably uniform, winter to summer. Winter, as if. But month to month, the days are remarkably uniform, and the sun goes down what seems to me crazy early. There is a lot of dark in Hawaii. That means that the story that specifies darkness extending for a long, long time, it may in fact have something to do with the fact that nearly half of every single day is fully dark.
Is it also possible, since the geology over there is very active with volcanoes, that made it very dark? I know when Mount St. Helens blew up here, it became very dark.
Never when I've been there. There's always activity going on, but it doesn't obscure the sun much. You get vog a lot, but you smell that and see it only a little, volcanic smog. But you smell it a fair amount and see it a little, but it makes it grayer when you're in the region, but not dark.
Okay.
I'm pondering if we are thinking of darkness only as negative and light only as positive, as enlightenment. I think light can also be very harsh. Think of the babies which are being born, the harshness of the light. We need to have sunglasses on when we are out in the sun. We need to protect ourselves. I have the feeling in this culture, darkness is not so something really bad.
That is.
Maybe it's something good.
It is incredibly important what you just noticed. In fact, when the missionaries came to Hawaii, when they were first told the Kumulipo and discovered that this story has dark, 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 and light only at the end, after there's evidence of, in fact, European presence. The lists of different kinds of people show awareness of present of people from around the world. The missionaries said, ah, and we came to bring light. And the Hawaiian said, actually, no. Light is not a negative thing there, but dark is the powerful, creative, generative reality, and light is just what comes next until you can get to the next dark, which is where generativity is lodged.
Another, even in the Bible, light has an unpleasant aspect in that the inability to stand before God.
Yes. Yes. The nine directions I can go, and I'm trying to figure which of the nine I need to do right away. Let me stew on that a little bit. But a piece, for sure. The simple notion that all things are solved by enlightenment. It's a Western notion that we hold dear, and I am a fan of the enlightenment all in all. But the simple notion that all things are solved by more light, to quote Goethe on his deathbed, is too simple a notion. It surely is the case in the Hawaiian story that dark is as productive as a fertile womb in this story. And dark is therefore good, life-giving, loving, passionate, the source of productive ambiguity, all of those things. And light is, in the Kumulipo, unimportant enough to wait until the day is unimportant enough to wait until the very last line. It may be that in biblical texts, we ought reassess the meaning of light and dark as well.
The idea that humans sometimes cannot, you can be destroyed by,
yes,
you know, the face of, it reminds me, you know, perhaps that it's inappropriate to mention here, but of you know, the light of the first nuclear blast. I mean,
shadows.
I don't mean to say that God is, you know, I don't think of our God as destructive at all, but there is nevertheless light, or perhaps even wisdom, is in the tree in the Garden of Eden that can be destructive.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I am wondering about chant, and I am wondering if there is something about the equator that brings forth chant, because we taught in Tanzania for 3 months at the Lutheran Institute at Kiambole, and they just love to chant and dance a saga, and the saga can be a sending saga that was sung toward the end of the time we were there, but it can also be just a rhythmic, joyful dance. I do mean dance. This one student loved to do that, and then the people would, the rest of the student body would join in on a chorus every so often, and it was just such a wonderful, wonderful thing.
On the basis of your experience, was the dance essential to the performed act, or would it have been just as good if they had held themselves very Midwestern still?
No.
Okay, the dance was essential.
Dance was essential.
Was the singing essential?
The singing was essential.
What did they contribute to the act?
What did they
contribute to the act that was being performed? What made the dance essential? They always did it, but what did it add?
Well, it added, let's see. Yeah, the word, joyful and happiness, it added that to the text.
What would you see as that layer of meaning? Because it surely does. Can we poke at what the layer of meaning, the physical action, and use of the voice in ways that are formalized by chant? What does that add? What is that layer of meaning?
I think when you're telling a story, particularly if you're excited about a story, your inflection changes. Mm-hmm. And the level of excitement takes your voice higher, but you also drop your voice to make a point, and I cannot tell a story without using my hands. So I sort of go into motion when I'm telling a story. And I think that's probably all extension of expression that inevitably comes up.
This is a chant with the same kinds of layers of meaning added by physical movement and ritualized vocal inflection. Anybody know anything about Hawaiian music, chanting, or dancing? Anybody studied that ever at any point? I'm going to play you a little piece. It's a short one. It is not the Kumulipo. I don't own that. But this is a piece gathered by the Bishop Museum, and it is an old traditional chanter. You can find Hawaiian music, including Don Ho, please know. You can find all sorts of Hawaiian music. It all partakes of some of the same roots. But the ancient music and the preserved stuff at the Bishop Museum is, to my ear, far more interesting. But here's what it sounds like. What'd you notice? Not very much like Don Ho. What did you hear? What did you notice?
Drums.
In fact, the oldest chants are drum alone. Addition of any other instrument is a later innovation.
Mm-hmm. It tends to be somewhat of a singular tone, a little bit, basically stays pitch-wise.
And that's the thing that surprised me most. The oldest chants that the Bishop Museum has are, in fact, very, very straight chants with bumps, but a very ritualized sound. Celebratory songs are that way. Funeral songs are that way. There is something about chanting that requires, some of it sounds like Episcopal liturgy, in fact, a very level tone with flexes.
That leads to light hypnosis.
Yes.
With the drumming.
Yes.
And with a lot of variation in pitch.
Yes.
You don't have that.
Yes. And that may be essential to the act of Hawaiian song. Then the repetition is repeated also, not just in the words and sounds, but also in the tones and in the drum beat. In the oldest stuff, the drum beat is very, very regular. And it is therefore, like so many traditional forms, semi-trance states are involved. No, they don't do trance. body, but they generate a kind of consciousness that, that gains focus through the repetition and the special ritual of voice. Anything else? Yeah.
Well, my goodness. So in Tanzania, it's drums.
Yeah.
I mean, is this equator culture we're talking about here around the world? Boy, that'd be...
Well, my friends who are Lakota aren't near the equator,
no,
and the drum is the voice of the earth.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it is traditional culture that knows that drums reveal the heartbeat. Did you hear the low beat at the end?
Yeah.
Drums reveal the heartbeat of life. That always is true, and it is here.
The level tone and rhythmic nature also remind me of what little I know of Hawaiian dance and movement, whereas I think in African cultures, you know, a lot of big movement, a lot of moving of your back, moving of your legs, and kind of jumping and leaping. In Hawaiian dance, I think it's much more grounded.
Yes.
The feet are much more planted, and you have movement of hands that mean things, and movement of hips, but not a lot of like big, huge arm movements or big kicking or jumping, which kind of...
In fact, no. Women dance, no big kicking or jumping. Fiji dances, male Fiji dancers, but Hawaiian male dancers mostly do not. And women do not. The feet are in contact with the ground at all times. And in fact, oldest Hawaiian dance is seated with hands only and no motion other. And some Hawaiian dance is standing with hands only. Some is standing only with no motion other than from the waist up, and others involves full body. I understand hula far too little, and some of it was in fact twisted. The grass skirt was introduced by Europeans to Hawaii because it was more sexually arousing. It was a Fiji reality that they brought there and said this would be cooler for tourists, they'll come here more. Ish. The culture was happily sexual without the European marketing of it, but anyway. From what I've been taught by people that dance, the chants could be performed anyway with full body involvement down to old arm and hand only. The music could be chanted like this, but there are forms also that in fact involve more moving melodies. But those compositions tend to be more recent. Kumulipo is very old.
Yeah. Can I jump?
Yes, please.
Genesis 1.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a priestly text,
yeah.
If it's a liturgical text,
yes.
Is sung.
In fact, all of Jewish scripture is cantillated.
But this particularly in liturgy,
mm-hmm.
Maybe right from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And I think Hebrew cantillation is not like, probably was not like cantillation we think of it now as it comes from the Middle Ages. It's much more sort of, I would think it's much more basic, more sort of, in some ways perhaps.
Yes. Can anyone here sing Hebrew text? I cannot. I'm part of a Hebrew reading group, and we are reading Genesis now. The other partners in the group are all Jews, and when I'm sitting and reading with them, all of a sudden somebody stops and says, hold it, what's the cantillation for that? And then the whole room sings the text to figure out how to translate it. The argument that the rabbis make is that the text was originally sung. Now, you've got to be aware with rabbinic arguments that they are always playing on a couple of levels at the same time, and usually telling you a joke to get you to think backwards just in case. But the argument is not the possibility is not altogether strange. In fact, traditional cultures sing and drum dance their traditional stories. What if Genesis 1 is properly sung? What would the music sound like? Now, I cannot sing the cantillation. I've colleagues can, I need them to teach me. I definitely need them to teach me. Let's look at and think about Genesis 1 next to Kumolipo. Oh, I know, we have 10 minutes left. There's not enough time, but given that we have to bash through and given that I want to strike a couple of sparks, I'm going to leap there, even though there's such good stuff there. We can go back, but just for now, let me read you just a bit. I've read you Genesis 1 in its entirety twice. I'll read you just a bit. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, "Let there be a dome in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." So God made the dome and separated the waters that were under the dome from the waters that were above the dome. And it was so. God called the dome sky, and there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. You've heard the rest. Look here. Given what Kumolipo has tuned your ear to hear, anything strike?
Well, it seems that with the chanting and with the movement, it creates a tangible presence. You're putting it into your body, you're putting it into, you know, feeling the rhythm and the vibrations, and so it's a connection with the past, with the story itself, and making it more of a reality in the present.
And so
changing it, it makes it a very different story when you connect it to you right now. Instead of saying, this is where I come from, this is what I am.
Yes.
Thank you. Let me pull about 9 threads. First thread. You've read the English, you've looked at the Hawaiian. It's pretty easy to read the Hawaiian rhythmically. Oke au I ka huli wele ka hu honua. Oke au I ka huli lole ka lani. Oke au I kukuk iaka kala. The rhythm is really easy to read there, even when you read it haltingly, as I'm able. Can you make the English rhythmic? At the time when the earth became hot, at the time when the heavens turned about, at the time when the sun was darkened to cause the moon to shine, do you feel the way that's schlumping along? It's trying to be rhythmic every once in a while. I taught a seminar this spring, and the class tried to make that translation into rhythm, and oy, did it go badly. What happens when you translate is that you cut the connection to what Liz was saying, the old way this has always been done. That, of course, is an argument that we all must learn Hebrew, which I, of course, would second, third, fourth, whatever you need. But if there is a rhythm, a dance, a beat that is older than even the vicissitudes of language in the story, Genesis might have that beat too, and we lose it in English, or we ought to convince our translators to look for it and try to get it back.
Well, I read about some research being done in liturgies today, any of them. Well, of course, the English, making the Roman liturgy English was a problem. And my kids tell the folks tale about Molly's husband, that he quit going to Mass when they made the liturgy, had the liturgy in English, and I don't even know whether it's true or not. My kids say that. But anyway, it's the same problem. When you have a liturgy in its original language, the rhythm, and you're participating in the rhythm by singing and or dancing, really affects how you think if you don't go to sleep because you're so tired of hearing it.
Yes.
And yes. So there's a tension. And even in the book Ceremony by Leslie Marmon Silka.
I was just talking about that today.
She talks about the need for even in the medicine traditions for the new material to be brought in or the liturgical, it tends to die. And And, but if you bring too much new in, then there is a, then people have a hard time relating to it. But there is this really positive effect of participation in something that you know well and say over and over, that it affects not only your mind but your behavior.
It is a related point, but it is one of the most remarkable things. Anyone who has joined a worship service in a nursing home knows that there will be people there who have not spoken a coherent word in a decade. My grandmother was one. She spoke, first she left English behind and then spoke Swedish only. And in the last decade of her life, she spoke Swedish word salad, just noises. Except when the pastor came and the Lord's Prayer began and my grandmother spoke coherent English again. And then she went back to Swedish word salad. There is something about the rhythms of that that draw out the ability yet to speak, which may be something important about the Hawaiian version, which is a set of rhythms and a beat and a set of sounds that Hawaiians have made to begin the story of the birth of all life from the womb of darkness. What if Genesis is properly a rhythmic chant, a song, a dance? Do you hear anything else in there that sounds Kumo Lipo-like?
Bang. Yes. And there was evening, and there was morning.
Yes. And while the refrain in the Kualipo is still it was night, in Genesis 1, the refrain is a return to the daily cycle, and therefore it is similar. It functions, in fact, perhaps the same way. What else? The repetition, even the small repetitions. You've got that large refrain that comes back, but you've got in the middle, God said, God saw, God said, God saw, God separated, God separated, God separated, God separated. All of those pieces come back fully rhythmically.
And it was good.
And it was good.
And it was good. And it was very good.
Yes. And those pieces are just as rhythmic as anything that you can find in the Kumalipo. What would happen if we found translations that honored the rhythmic ideas? Because Hebrew rhymes ideas, not words. What if we found ways to catch the rhythms and the rhythmic rhyme still in the Hebrew text and brought it into English? What would we discover about this old chant? Let me say one other thing before we finish this week. Something, this is a piece that leans into next week, and it's a piece that's important. It's something that surprised me when I started messing with origin stories around the world. One of the things I noticed first is something that you've seen as we've read together. Origin stories have elements in them that appear to have come from, as a result of European contact. There are elements that might be post-colonial contact elements. We don't always know, but they probably often are. That's important because origin stories appear to be among the most agglomerative stories that that we have access to. They take new things, envelop them, and then chew on them until they can do something with them. That's important. There's a book you might want to read if you are interested in traditional story. The book is called Homo Narrans. Homo spelled Homo, Narrans with a couple of R's. The book is by John Niles, spelled like the river, but a couple of them. Niles' argument is that human beings are not properly Homo sapiens, We are not properly wise hominids, although we surely are. We are not necessarily properly, essentially described as homo ludens, although that's a title that I like particularly well, playful hominids. We are, says Niles, properly storytelling beasts. We are hominids who cannot stop telling stories, homo neurons. He says storytelling is the essential human act. That argument by itself, of course, is going to interest me. But the part that's fascinating is his discussion of weak tradition bearers. A weak tradition bearer for Niles is someone who learns the story exactly as it has always been said and repeats it as exactly as it has always been said. Rote memorization and preservation. Weak tradition bearers are essential to the continuity of any human tradition. You need people that learn it exactly as it is and keep it exactly as it is. Generation after generation, a world without end, amen. But, Niles argues, every tradition that we have is in fact preserved essentially by strong tradition bearers. Weak tradition bearers are essential because they preserve, they freeze it for when you're going to need to take it out to feed company. But when company comes in the form of Europeans and Americans sailing up on your shores, strong tradition bearers take new tools, new words, new ideas, new challenges, and pull them inside the tradition, and they reform the tradition from the heart out. Without strong tradition bearers, all you have are museum pieces, mm-hmm. preserved in formaldehyde, mm-hmm. finally. Strong tradition bearers are those that make the traditions, the origin stories, agglomerative. Because strong tradition bearers bring in the blondes who have white skin. Did you notice that at the end? No Hawaiians that look like that. That's the first piece. The second piece that is important is in origin story after origin story, as you read the histories of them, one of the things that appears to be really, if not universally true, how would I know that, but at least widely true, the origin stories that we have are stories that bear the marks of a strong tradition bearer who reworked the story at a time of cultural crisis. The Bumba Vomits the World story, scholars say, shows signs of cultural crisis that this responds to. Story after story does that. One of the things that's interesting about the Kumalipo is the form we have it in. Well, first of all, finishes with thousands of lines of genealogies, king names. The last king name in the Kumulipo is David Kalakaua, the last king of quasi-independent Hawaii. If you know anything about king lists, you know that there is always an argument about who belongs in and who belongs out. Dynasties are not neat, simple affairs. There's always an argument about whether the branch should have gone this way or that way. And that means there's always argument about who the true king of France is, even when there was a king of France. Same thing was true when there was a king of Hawaii. Who's the true king? Not everyone agreed that it was Kalakaua. Why, under cultural pressure, at the time when American interests primarily were stealing the land and forcing the culture into oblivion and claiming, draining the islands dry, why would the Kumalipo carefully say, and the king who follows at the end of this long genealogy is Kalakaua? Well, it says Kalakaua, whatever the Americans do to him, against him, around him, is in fact the king who is properly king. But let me ask you to think about something more basic. What does it mean that the end of the Kumalipo is a genealogy at all? What does that indicate? That after the piece that I had you read comes
more than 1,000 lines of genealogy. What? Make up a reason that that would be important, given what you see in the Kumalipo.
The genealogy connects you to that story.
Okay, and how? I mean, of course it does, because the end of the Kumalipo is all these names up to Kalakaua, and so you're connected in...
I was thinking it's like Matthew 1.
Yes, yes, because it establishes a long, continuous list of people that have a great deal in common, that for sure. What else?
Doesn't it also, in the absence of what we call hypothesis and theory building, establish a validity basis?
It's an argument in the face of cultural pressure that Kalakaua is valid and culture is valid. Very important. Let me point you to one big thing. At the time when the earth became hot, at the time when the heavens turned about, at the time when the sun was darkened to cause the moon to shine, the time of the rise of the Pleiades, the slime, this was the source of the earth, the source of the darkness that made darkness, the source of the night that made night, the intense darkness, the deep darkness, darkness of the sun, darkness of the night, nothing but night, the night gave birth. Born was Kumalipo, born was Po'ele, born was the coral polyp, born was the grub, born was his child, born was the starfish, born was the sea cucumber, born was Kalakaua. The genealogy doesn't just, is not just an appendix on the end of the Kumalipo. It establishes a chain of birth that goes back to the primordial slime out of which all things come. The king list is continuous with the creative energy that makes the world. All the kings were born as were all the beings that are. The story in the face of cultural pressure says not just Kalakaua's legitimate king, but this line of Hawaiian culture is what was born finally out of the slime. Where the others came from? They ended later. But we come out of the slime, which is where life comes from. Why slime? Wale wale is the word for slime. Why slime? Best guess, scholars say, is because this is a taro eating culture. And taro grows in muck. And it pokes up above the muck. The next trip, we've been invited to bring students to plant taro with the traditional Hawaiian community, and I cannot wait to go, because that's the slime out of which life comes. One last parenthesis. The story we have in Genesis 1 and 2 is a story that comes also from a time of cultural crisis. It was, in fact, utterly reformed at a time when culture was under pressure like they had never seen. Next week, we're going to burrow into the cultural pressure and examine it with some care and look at how Genesis 1, more particularly Genesis 2, responds specifically to the cultural crisis. That's what we're up to all of next week. We've got some different things to do. This week is preamble. Next week is the heavy spade work. So come ready. We're going to mess with stories close. Thank you so much for all that you brought to these discussions. Thank you.
Thank you.